We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. It's long been a basic principle of American foreign policy that the United States government does not talk with terrorists, that doing so would give them political legitimacy and also undermine our efforts to promote democracy around the world. Our guest for this hour, foreign affairs writer Mark Perry, takes a different view. He says not only that we should talk with these groups, we have been talking with them successfully, in some cases, at least for many years. This morning, in this first hour of our show, Mark Perry will talk with us about a recent book that he has authored. The title is Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. It's published by Basic Books. In this book, he makes the argument that diplomacy with extremists may indeed be the only way to end terrorism. Mark Perry is a military intelligence and foreign affairs analyst and writer. His articles have appeared in many places, including The Nation, The Washington Post, The LA Times. He's the author of a number of books, and this is just one, Talking to Terrorists. He's joining us this morning by phone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. We do ask people that if you're going to call in, please do make it a question. Make it on the topic and be brief. That'll help us get in as many different callers as possible and keep our program moving. But, of course, input from listeners, that is welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455 is the one to use. And if you'd like to send your questions by email, that address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And Mr. Perry, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. And just as a way of starting off, to qualify things a little bit, I think I would want to give you the opportunity to say that when you talk about something, use a phrase like talking to terrorists, I think that you would say that clearly that there are some people, some groups that, in fact, we can't talk with. So it's not a kind of a blanket sort of a statement.
No, that's exactly right. For instance, I would not advocate, never have advocated, talking to Al-Qaeda. And this simply isn't happenstance. There's a good reason for it. Unlike the groups that I think we ought to be having a dialogue with, Al-Qaeda doesn't have a constituency. It's a network, a gang, and it doesn't have really a political program. Its goal is to disrupt and kill and to oppose the United States. There really isn't anyone to talk to. I distinguish between somebody like Al-Qaeda and Hamas and Hezbollah because Hamas and Hezbollah has a deeply rooted constituency. They provide social programs to their constituency, and they have a very well understood and, I think, very sophisticated political program. So I do make distinctions between what we commonly call terrorist groups and unfortunately lumped together. I wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that some people taking the two groups that you mentioned, Hezbollah and Hamas, and they might say that while they would acknowledge what you say, that these are groups that actually have constituencies and they have political programs, they might also say that their political programs are antithetical to the interests of the United States. So that their goals and our goals in the region are very different. And for that reason, I guess, again, they would say, well, it's just not possible to talk with somebody when what they want and what we want is so different.
Well, I think it's a good debate. Is what they want and what we want really that different? Hamas has come out most recently and said that it would, under some circumstances, recognize Israel, but as the result of political negotiations. It's made it very clear that it doesn't view the United States as an enemy, that it doesn't target Americans. In fact, there hasn't been a suicide bombing of any kind conducted by Hamas inside of Israel since August of 2004. And Hamas and the Hamas leadership in Damascus and in Gaza have been reaching out to the United States. And finally, and I think most importantly, and this is true for Hezbollah also, Hamas and Hezbollah are targeted by Al-Qaeda. Their leaders are targeted for assassination by Al-Qaeda and its affiliated groups. for participating in democracy, which in democratic elections, which Al-Qaeda considers a Zionist American plot to overthrow the world. Hamas and Hezbollah don't look at it that way. They're happy, and they have embraced democratic principles and run in elections. In January of 2006, Hamas won a democratic election in the Palestinian Authority. And Hezbollah has regularly participated in elections in Lebanon and is even a part of the government. So they're very, very different kinds of organizations than what we normally would consider terrorist organizations. But, it's a good debate. There are people on the other side of this who think we shouldn't talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Are there particular examples that you could cite when there has been talk between the government of the United States and a group that in a public way had been considered to be a terrorist group? So an example of a place where we, in fact, had been talking with terrorists, to use that phrase, where you would say this actually had yielded positive benefits.
There are two very good examples, one better than the other. The first example is we talked to the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, in the late 1980s, in 88 and 89, and they had to meet some conditions for those discussions, which took place in Tunis, but they did, and it paved the way for the Oslo Agreement and a broader attempt to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I think those were very successful talks. And the second and the most important, of course, is our willingness and the South African government's willingness to talk to the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela. That paved the way for the end of apartheid. Those talks were a signal success in world history, and I think we see the results in a very stable, democratic, majority-controlled South Africa today. So those are the two most salient examples.
Mm. And did that in some way depend on some sign from those groups that they were willing to change significantly their ways of operating or their goals?
The most important stipulation that both groups had to make was the pledge to renounce violence during the period of negotiations for a political solution to their problems. This was difficult to do on the part of the PLO because they had a broad constituency and very diverse one, and they couldn't take the decision easily. But once they took the decision to renounce terrorism, to renounce violence during the course of negotiations, they followed it. They followed that pledge. There were hiccups along the way, of course, but in the era prior to Oslo, they did that. In the case of the ANC, it was also a little different. They had difficulty renouncing violence because their claim, justifiably, I think, was that the government was conducting violent operations against them. But the stipulations made between Prime Minister de Klerk of South Africa and Nelson Mandela about the kind of environment that they would shape prior to negotiations also worked, and those detailed understandings were kept by both sides.
Hmm. When it comes to the Middle East, I think that some people would argue, perhaps also we'll lump into that our involvement in West Asia and places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, that the model that we have been following now for a long time just isn't working, and that somehow we have to change direction, change focus, change priority, I don't know what you want to call it, but take a new and a different kind of approach. Is that something that you would agree with? And if you would say yes, well, then in what way do you think that it would be good to change our approach?
I think it is possible to change the approach, and I would advocate that we change the approach, but I think it's difficult in the case of both Iraq and Afghanistan. In Talking to Terrorists, my book Talking to Terrorists, I lay out a story that unfolded over a period of many years from July of 2004 until mid-2006 of the U.S. Marine Corps and some very brave Marine officers who met with the Iraq insurgency in Amman under the guise of an economic conference. And it took a long time. These meetings took a long time to yield real benefits. But the attempt of the Marines was to convince the Iraq resistance, the non-Al-Qaeda Iraq resistance, that America was not their enemy and that Al-Qaeda was their enemy. There were fits and starts, collapses in negotiations. But at the end, and at the same time as the surge, these groups decided they would turn their guns on al-Qaeda and away from the Americans. And it was really quite a revolutionary change and a very difficult one, I think, for the Iraqi resistance to make. But they did. And it transformed our war in Iraq, and it led to increased stability in Iraq, the chances for elections, and a broader government. It was really quite a signal success. That's the story I relate in talking to terrorists. I think in Afghanistan it's a little bit more difficult. We could open to the Taliban, but which one? There are at least seven different political forms of the Taliban, and it's not clear who they control or what they control or when they could control them. And it's going to be much more difficult, but I think that it could yield real benefits. And I don't discount that it's already happening. I think that the U.S. military is on the ground conducting a dialogue with several different insurgent groups in Afghanistan in an attempt to dampen the violence and pave the way for a political solution. And I think that we should support that.
Mm-hmm. And that's following that same model that was developed. And you would argue, and I think a lot of other people would argue as well, had been successful in Iraq.
Yes, it was successful in Iraq, and I would add, it's not clear it's going to be successful in Afghanistan, but there have been some, let's say, political hints that these talks are going forward and that they're yielding some benefit. I think that the result of the talks in both places, in Iraq and Afghanistan, was a realization on both sides, that is, on the American side, on the side of the insurgents, that there wasn't going to be a clear military victory from either party, and that the only way to stabilize the government, stabilize the country, was through dialogue. This isn't World War II, where one side is going to sign a surrender agreement and the fighting is going to stop. This could drag on for years, and rather than have that happen, the United States has chosen to pick and choose groups that we deem as more moderate than others who are interested in a political solution, and we're approaching them.
Mm-hmm. And just to underscore what you said, that going back to that point when we were talking about the surge, when the administration, Bush administration, decided to put significantly more troops into Iraq, I think that a lot of people have pointed to that and said, well, it was this change in strategy, particularly working with insurgents who were willing to ally with the United States against al-Qaeda, the so-called awakening, that this was actually much more significant in yielding results, if there were positive results, than simply putting in more troops. And it was that sort of idea that was then taken from there that was taken to Afghanistan.
Yes, that's exactly right. Or as I say in my book, you know, the decision that made the difference in Iraq was not sending Marines to kill insurgents, but sending Marines to talk to them. That's what made a huge difference and led to the political solution, albeit still a very rocky one in Iraq that's made a difference.
Yeah, whose idea was that? And were these people, these Marines that were engaged in these talks, were they in fact authorized by someone to do that?
When Talking to Terrorists came out, I expected the Marine Corps and my friends in the military to stand up and applaud the book. They were very hesitant to do so because they didn't get any orders to do this. In fact, it was opposed by the State Department and the White House, and there were even investigations of the Marines who were doing this. It was not planned. It was not part of a bigger strategy. It was an on-the-ground decision by high-ranking Marine Corps officers that the military strategy the United States was following wasn't working. I praise General James Conway, who is the current commandant of the Marine Corps, commander of the Marine Corps, as the guy who told his staff, go do this, go meet these guys, we need to find a way out of this. And James Mattis, who is the current commander at the U.S. Central Command, who said, absolutely, this has got to be done. And they did so in the face of real obstacles put in their path by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and by the White House, who really didn't want it done, and obviously by the Iraqi interim government, Iyad Alawi, at the time, who also didn't want it done. But it was done anyway, and it worked.
This is something I think it's interesting, and might well be the kind of thing that would start an argument, or at least people would want it to argue with you, that you actually have some good things to say about Don Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense, where you said, yes, certainly he made mistakes. His battle plan for Iraq was wrong. But you also say that when things really began to go bad, he was very pained about it, and at least privately he was, and that he indeed supported this opening to the insurgency in the face of opposition from the administration. As you say, the State Department and the White House were both very much opposed to this.
Well, you're exactly right. When the book came out, some of my progressive fans, friends called me after having read it and said, "You're a friend of Donald Rumsfeld?" And I said, "Well, I met Donald Rumsfeld, and I actually do admire him for a period of time where he was really heavily criticized, and in public he was an acerbic, arrogant, outspoken supporter of the Bush administration's policy, which was clear to everyone wasn't working. And he wasn't well-liked in the press. But at the same time that he was appearing in public and saying giving very acerbic and caustic remarks, privately he was, how should I put it, privately he was haunted by what was happening in Iraq and about how it had gone wrong. And anyone who's had experience with top military or civilian officials during a time of war realized that it's very difficult to sit at a desk in the Pentagon and get a list of Americans who have died every single day, another list, and then another list. And that's what happened to Donald Rumsfeld, and it really started to bother him. And he reached out for civilian and military officials in our government to say, isn't there something we can do? Isn't there an option here? Can't we identify someone we can talk to? How do we stop the fighting? For him, it wasn't just a matter of deploying more troops and killing more insurgents. He really wanted a solution, and I think it was because he was so driven by the increase in American casualties, which he said he had said would not happen. So I do praise him for that. I think he worked hard to try to find a solution.
Mm. Also, you've said that some striking things about the Bush administration and their thinking and the importance of 9/11, that if you go back and you think about the things that Mr. Bush said when he was running for president, that things that really sounded almost isolationist. Certainly, these things he said about not wanting to be involved in nation building. Your argument is, well, when he said that, he actually meant it, but that all that kind of went out the window with 9/11, and that in place there were people in and around the administration who had this set of ideas about how the United States should operate in the world, and they were the ones that then started to shape the policy, and that was the policy until things started going very badly wrong.
Yeah, that's right. I spent some time, many months, talking to a group of neoconservatives, Joshua Maroncheck and others, here in Washington, and I said, you know, I asked them, how did you become so prominent? You have such an influence on the Bush administration's foreign policy. How did that happen? And Joshua Maroncheck, who was then a very senior intellectual at the American Enterprise Institute, smiled at me one day and he said, well, it was very odd. We woke up on September 12th, on 9/12, and suddenly our phones were ringing. Before that, they weren't. It's difficult now to remember, but prior to 9/11, the Bush presidency was going to be a domestic presidency, a very conservative, domestic, balancing budget presidency, almost a classic conservative presidency. And on the afternoon of 9/11, the Bush administration searched around for people who would know the Middle East and had a view on the Middle East, and they chose the neoconservatives. They might have chosen differently. But 9/11 really put this kind of expansionist foreign policy view on the agenda for the United States. And it brought into prominence people who believe that we could transform the Middle East into bastions of democracy at the point of a gun. I think it was a terrible mistake. And I think the administration in its last year and a half and 2 years realized it was a terrible mistake and began to shift the policy. But before that, this expansionist foreign policy that had the pillars of democracy and Americanization at its core were really prominent and were really running our foreign policy and just simply wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. And I think that gets at an important point here. I think if people will remember back, think back to when the arguments were being made about whether or not we should go into Iraq. I think even now people will be confused because at different times, different people speaking for the administration were giving very different justifications, depending on who they were and depending on who they were trying to appeal to. And I think that as it turns out, it was rather complicated and that in some sense, all of those things were true. That is, when people talked about weapons of mass destruction, they meant it. And when people talked about terrorism, they meant it. And when people talked about oil, well, they meant it. But that also there was this kind of overarching idea about the United States, its power in the world, its place in the world, and this feeling that with the application of enough force that we could make the world over into our image and that would be good for us and would be good for the world. Now people might scoff at that, but I think that indeed at that time, the people who were advancing that kind of idea actually did believe that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, you hate to say something like this, but maybe one of the worst things that could have happened to our foreign policy was the fall of the Berlin Wall. And, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union and the decline of the Warsaw Pact and the deterioration of, you know, worldwide socialism and that entire movement, which seemed to happen in an eye blink, might have been the worst thing that could have happened to us because we were the last man standing, so to speak. We had enormous political, economic, and military power in the world. No one could even come close. So the idea of the neoconservatives was this is a once in a 2,000 year opportunity for a nation, a beneficent democracy, to wield its power in the world for good and to extinguish all challenges to our authority and to spread democracy. But easier said than done. You get caught up in a war that should be an easy one-off like the Iraq War. We just defeated their army in less than a week and their air force and overthrew their government, and you stand up and the people throw petals in front of rose petals in front of your tanks and applaud you. And that's not what happened. You know, we're dealing with political movements that are very, very strong, with people who don't want Americans on their soil. And in some respects, doesn't matter how many aircraft carriers you deploy, these are complex political problems that need complex political solutions to be resolved, and they can't be resolved at the point of a gun. I think that's the lesson we learned.
Mm. Well, I have a caller here. Let me ask you just one other point that you have talked about how things changed dramatically for the United States and its policies on 9/11. You also say that the day when everything changed again was the day when Robert Gates became the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
And now, of course, Mr. Gates has said he's now stated his intention to step down. Why was that important?
Because Robert Gates is I'm an unabashed admirer of Robert Gates, as you've implied. And when Robert Gates came to the podium to accept the job as Secretary of Defense, I was in Beirut, and I turned to a colleague, and I said, from this moment forward, everything changes. He has been, and he is a very careful political actor. He tends to slow down the pace of events. You know, there are people in every administration who say, hey, let's go do this, let's do this, let's do this. We have the power to do this. And he's always the guy at the table, at least this is my sense, who says, well, let's think about this. Let me go talk to so-and-so. I'll fly to Kurdistan. I'll talk to the head of the Kurdish government. I'll go to Turkey. I'll come back. Let's do a study of it. Let's not deploy too many troops right now. Let's just think about this. Maybe things will change tomorrow. He's that kind of a political thinker who tends to slow down the pace of things and to take the ardor off ideologues. He's not an ideologue. He's a very pragmatic, practical, deep-thinking, good, bureaucratic, infighting politician who understands the way the world works. And I think you can mark the turnaround in our foreign policy and the beginning of a much more sophisticated foreign policy on the part of this country from the moment that he took office as Secretary of Defense.
Hmm. Well, is it a loss now, his stated intention now to resign?
Well, in 5 years, I think he's become one of the greatest secretaries of defense that we've had, and what he wants to take on in his last year is procurement reform and the Pentagon budget. He has the stature and the political status to do that. I don't know of anyone else who does have that stature. So I think it is a loss. He's got a lot of work to do in his last year, and maybe he can make real inroads in the Pentagon budget, which is out of control. I hope his successor can do it, but I'm skeptical.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Mark Perry. He's a military intelligence and foreign affairs analyst and writer. His articles have appeared in The Nation, The Washington Post, The LA Times, among other papers. He's the author of 7 books. His most recent, the one we're talking about here this morning, is titled Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. Basic Books is the publisher. We have a caller here. Others are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send along your emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's our first caller in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I have 2 comments. The first is the notion that the American foreign policy was that of spreading democracy and Americanization. I think that probably wasn't what a very large part of the American public thought we were doing. It may even have been what George Bush thought he was doing, but I don't think that was at all what the neocons thought they were doing. At the time, they were not only talking about the new American colonial empire, but they were writing articles about it, and I would cite, I believe his name was Friedman in The Atlantic in 2001 or two.
Yes.
And certainly this was the way people outside the United States saw our foreign policy.
Yeah.
The other thing was your comment on the collapse of the Soviet Union, and I completely agree with you that this was a disaster for us. It had been in the cards for some time. The Soviet Union was on the verge of collapse for the better part of 20 years.
Yeah.
But we tend to forget that the Soviet Union in 1918 was a third world country. Its factories were largely manned not by slaves, but by serfs. And there was a remarkable transformation at a tremendous cost, largely at the hands of a monster, Stalin.
Yes. Well, you make 2 good points. The first point is really very good. My experience with the neoconservatives, many of whom are colleagues and friends, was that there were some who absolutely were not talking out of both sides of their mouth. They absolutely believed that the most important goal of American foreign policy ought to be the spread of democracy throughout the world. And it's the one part of their political philosophy, if you will, that I happen to agree with. I think that we should be promoters of democracy. The problem with neoconservatives is that there were some, and are some in the movement, who really don't believe that and who think that different rules apply in the Middle East. So that in 2006, when Hamas won the Palestinian election, the same neoconservatives who had been promoting democracy decided that they couldn't accept the result of the Palestinian election. And frankly, they sparked a program inside this government, inside, to a lesser extent, inside of Israel, to undermine that Hamas democratic government, and it has split the Palestinian political environment, and it split the neoconservative movement. But I think that the one thing lacking from the Obama foreign policy is this idea that, you know, we're for democracy. The big fear is that what's going to happen in the Middle East if we promote democracy is that Islamic fundamentalists will come into office. My answer to that is, well, so be it. They're going to have to solve the same problems that the current family regimes are trying to solve, and that is balance the budget and spur economic prosperity. But it proved to be, this question of democracy proved to be a very difficult one for neoconservatives to handle, and it is still a very difficult one for neoconservatives to handle because they bump square into the problem of electing the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which they don't want.
Thank you. I am enjoying your comments.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that you touch on something that is a difficult issue. That is, the criticism has been of the United States government as we talk about wanting to support democracy until somebody has an election and the people get elected that we don't like. And that what you're saying is, well, that's just tough. We're just going to have to live with that. At the same time, it seems difficult to sort of stand back if you see if we're going from a situation where we have a government that seems to be a friend. Some people would argue that it's more that it's a government that's a client, to a case where we have a government that maybe officially is hostile to the United States. It seems that for a government to just stand back and say, well, that's okay with us, that's almost more than you could expect.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I'm a strong believer in the promotion of democracy, but I understand what happens. And what happens and what's going to happen in some of these countries is what happened in Iran in 1979, where you have a revolution that overthrows a dictator and replaces the dictator with a military, what has turned out to be, frankly, a military regime. And it's very uncomfortable to promote democracy and have that happen. My argument is perhaps not as sophisticated as it should be, but I think is right. And that is, one thing that the United States has to learn, I believe, is patience, enormous patience, years and years of patience. The Iranian Revolution wasn't something that we welcomed or embraced, but it happened, and I think it was inevitable. And I also think that it's inevitable that sooner or later, maybe not tomorrow or next year, but inevitably and eventually, the Iranian government will become a democratic government, because that's what the people want. And that's what will happen, and we're just going to have to wait and wait and wait and work hard. There are no easy solutions here over long periods of time to promote the one thing that this country has to export, and that is democratic ideals. Democracy works as a form of government that dampens violence and leads to political stability.
And I think that gets to one of the things I think about Iran that frustrates a lot of people in the United States. That is, they would like to, within the U.S. government at least, they would like to do what could be done to, let's say, foster, accelerate that process. It doesn't seem, we don't exactly seem to know how to do that, but we have that impulse. And I think that probably there are a lot of people in Iran who would say, fight that impulse, because change there can be no appearance of involvement of the United States, because that would delegitimize whatever was going on inside Iran. So we just have to stay out of it.
Yeah, that's right. There may, however, be some things we can do, and there's a model provided about that. I remember at the in the middle of the Cold War in the 70s, the United States promoted the Helsinki Human Rights Committees in Eastern Europe, and conservatives rolled their eyes and said, "Oh, who are we kidding? These committees are going to be the absolute puppet of their Soviet masters. They're not going to be answerable to anyone. All these people are going to be thrown into jail. They're going to do absolutely no good. And you know, you guys on the left have your head in the clouds." Well, the Helsinki committees worked. When the wall fell, they were the political groups in place that had been working for two decades to foster democratic values and to prepare for the transition to a post-Soviet world. And in many countries, the members of those Helsinki committees emerged as the new democratic leadership. We could be doing the same thing in the Middle East, and we ought to be doing the same thing in the Middle East, and that is identifying democratic forces and people who care about their countries, care about their people. Whether they're friend or foe of ours at the moment, I think hardly matters. But people who represent large constituencies in Egypt or Jordan or Saudi Arabia, because the one thing that we've learned over history is that dictatorships are viable, but only temporarily so, and inevitably. And I think in Egypt, primarily, the current political leadership is untenable, unstable, and unworkable, and does not have the support of the people.
Mm. I have an email from somebody who I guess I would say is highly skeptical of the talk about promoting democracy, and I think is one of those people, and I think that there are other people who would agree that when people talk about promoting democracy, what they're really interested in is the United States government maintaining its kind of dominance around the world. When one talks about promotion of democracy, can you really divorce those two things? That is, what we think might indeed be in the best interest of people in some other country and what we think is in the best interest of the United States and its foreign policy and our ability to have influence around the world?
I think this is an extremely difficult question. The whole question about democracy is extremely difficult because we tend to bring to the table all of our everyday experiences. So we say, well, you know, not only democracy, but democracy ensures things like gay rights. Well, it's just not going to fly. That's just not going to work in the Middle East. And we're going to have to. I fall back on this explanation of patience. We're going to have to understand that this is something that's going to be in the hands of the people. I can tell you this: democracy comes about in very messy circumstances. Very often in revolutionary environments, and at that point, we're not going to have any choice but to step back. It's going to be completely out of our hands. And I would counsel Americans. And I've said this to friends in the Middle East. I said, you know, we're a lot less powerful than people think. And if anything proves that, it's our experience in Iraq. We can't change the world overnight. We are as much a victim of historical forces as the pusher of historical forces. We can't be everywhere at once, and we're not everywhere at once. And you can see in the Middle East a real tendency now towards democracy that we're not promoting, and that, I think, as I said before, is inevitable.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Mark Perry. We're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his recent book, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies, published by Basic Books. He's a military intelligence and foreign affairs analyst and writer. He's authored a number of books. Also, his articles have appeared in a number of places, including The Nation, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I know that you have said something like the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is the toughest in the world, and if we could solve that, we could solve anything. Well, and certainly it is the case that I think a lot of people make the argument is if that could be settled, then it would have a positive ripple effect for the politics of the entire region.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, we've been working on this for quite a long time now, and it doesn't seem to be much closer today than 10 years ago. Now, maybe it is. But that gets to the question, well, what could the United States do to try to settle that conflict?
Well, I'll make two comments, and one is reflective of what we've said over the last 45 minutes. You know, the neoconservatives and the people who advocated the invasion and regime change in Iraq said it's very clear that a military victory in Baghdad would shift the outlook of the entire region, and that it would have an incredible impact on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as it would teach the Palestinians that American power cannot be denied and cannot be effectively opposed, and that the road to Jerusalem, as they said, the road to Jerusalem leads through Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turned out that just the opposite was the case, that the one way that we, the United States, can have the biggest impact on the region is to show that we have good intentions when it comes to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the road to Baghdad and Amman and Cairo and Riyadh leads through Jerusalem. I think it is the most important agenda item, and perhaps even the only agenda item that we have in foreign policy in the region, in the resolution of the conflict, would have the greatest impact. That said, I agree with you. It is almost in the too tough box.
Mm-hmm.
It's been going on for 50 years, and it's not as simple as simply sitting down with a map and drawing boundaries. These are people who live right next to each other who don't like each other. And it is a remnant of colonialism and World War II and the partitions that we went through as an attempt to solve problems. And it's only going to happen when there's a political will for it to happen on the part of the Palestinians and the Israelis, and the political will, frankly, is not there. That said, and this is going to sound like a contradiction, it could happen tomorrow. There are some interesting things going on, especially among Israeli conservatives who are now starting to talk about a binational state, a state that includes the Palestinians, of bringing the West Bank Palestinians into a democratic structure in Israel and making it, for want of another phrase, the Israeli Republic of Palestine, that is, a Palestinian minority and a Israeli-Jewish majority inside a democracy. And the fact that the Israeli right is talking about this, not the left in Israel, the right, is very interesting. They see Israel not necessarily as solely a Jewish state, but as a binational democratic state, the most powerful in the Middle East, that would be an economic powerhouse, a nationalistic Israeli state. And I think that growth in thinking in Israel portends some real progress, perhaps in the near term.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, maybe not.
We have another caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what you thought about the idea that maybe the notion of democracy has been confused with capitalism. It seems that the United States government gives lip service to capitalism or democracy, but will support any form of government that caters to business interests, U.S. business interests. Mm-hmm. And that hypocrisy has to be obvious to most people. So I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Well, it's a good point, and I'm not sure I have a great answer, but one of the pillars of our democracy is free peoples, free votes, free markets, and we hesitate to control U.S. corporations operating overseas, so they tend to act with some impunity. We have laws in place to stop that, but they're able to trade overseas, and on top of that, they have an enormous lobbying power inside of Washington. So they have some effect on our foreign policy, perhaps even a significant impact. I don't see how we can break the ties between the two. American corporations, for better or worse, and American businesses, for better or worse, are the face of America overseas, and not necessarily and always a bad face. And I would add that in the Middle East, there's no argument here in the Middle East about free markets. You couldn't throw a stone 100 miles in any country in the Middle East and ever hit a socialist. They're just, they want to control their enterprises, and they do have state-owned industries. But politically, constituencies in these countries are conservative, and you'll find among the best capitalists in the world in Lebanon, Egypt, Tunisia, Oman, there is no winking socialism in any of these countries, and that's true even in Iran, where business interests, Iranian business interests, have enormous power inside the government. So while it might seem a contradiction between corporate power and democracy, I think in the Middle East it's really not so much, And that's a good thing, because if there was that kind of interference, it would cause a lot of problems. So you can, and I can almost hear you off the phone screaming about oil companies. But American oil companies that operate in these countries operate under the protection of the regimes, particularly in Saudi Arabia, which owns a huge hunk, more than 50% of Aramco. And they find American businesses and corporations doing business in that region a plus for the region.
About 5 minutes. Again, someone wants to call in here. I've got somebody to go here. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Over in the community of Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello. And in a few moments ago, you all were speaking about the policies in, between Israel and the Palestinians in the Middle East, and how we need to formulate a pattern that will solve the problem that's been unsolvable in the last 50 years. But the problem, the method we have never tried is to be absolutely equal on both sides. In other words, be a fair agent. In other words, what we do for Israel, we do for Palestine. What we do for Palestine, we do for Israel. And treat them both absolutely equal. Something we've never done. Where could that lead us?
Well, you're right, but we have to be realistic about this. I mean, I agree very strongly with your view on this. I think that we need to be more even-handed, and we haven't been even-handed. But on the other hand, every president is very mindful that there is a strong pro-Israel constituency in the United States, and there's no use not facing that reality politically. And then, too, imposing a solution on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict means, frankly, imposing a solution on Israel. And that's not only politically untenable, that would be absolutely the wrong thing to do, and it wouldn't work. Palestinians and Israelis have to come to the table willingly. And they have to realize they have no other choice. And that's not clear to them now. It's not clear to either party. They believe that by hanging on and continuing this low simmering conflict, they'll somehow get something. And we're not going to be able to nudge that off ground zero simply by giving a lecture. We're going to have to let this situation evolve. I think, frankly, the Obama administration is completely wrong in not opening to the Islamic resistance movement. They're a very strong political force. They have a strong constituency in the Palestinian Authority. I think we have to bring them into the talks. And I think once we do, we'll see progress. And until that point, we're just not going to.
Well, it also seems to me that there have been times when the United States acted as if we could have a solution by taking the leaders of both sides and locking them into a room and saying, we won't let you out until you figure something out.
Yeah.
And that's not going to achieve anything either, I think.
Yeah, this is what we call in some circles in Washington, it's called the Rodney King solution, which is, can't we all just get along? And if you put them in a room, the answer is no, we can't just all get along. There's going to have to be an increase in the willpower of both constituencies, Israelis and Palestinians, to get this done. And it can be done, but it's going to be very painful and perhaps even ugly, and it's going to mean the United States will have to lecture the Israelis and nudge and push the Israelis to do something that they see is clearly not in their own interest. And it's going to mean the deployment probably of American assets to the West Bank or to parts of the Middle East, and that's always another painful thing that can be done. But I think it will get done, and frankly, I think it'll get done. If there is a second Obama administration, it'll probably get done in the second Obama administration.
All right. Very quickly, another caller here, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
I regret I haven't been able to listen all, but just on the last interchange, you suggested you agreed with the caller that even-handedness was appropriate, but then you just sort of said that, what I think you should acknowledge is that the U.S. is underwriting this activity. No matter what the protestations are about pressure, et cetera, the U.S. hasn't done anything to pressure Israel to change. The last time somebody did that, I think, was the lame attempt to slow down the loan guarantees during Bush 1 administration.
During Bush 1, that's right.
But
I acknowledge what you say. But if you check out my biography, and I'm not urging you to do that necessarily, you'll find that I've been the one guy in Washington who stood up and said, this is not going to work. We're going to have to be tougher on Israel, a lot tougher than we are. But I think, that's easy for me to say. If you're the president of the United States and you have a recalcitrant Congress and domestic programs on the table that could be undermined by being tough on Israel, that's a very, very difficult political thing to do, and we have to be realistic about this. I think that barring the United States being tough on Israel, the Palestinians and the Israelis eventually and inevitably are going to have to sit down and figure out that it's in their own interest. And we may have another spasm of violence before that takes place. But, there's not a golden bullet here. Our being tough on Israel isn't automatically going to lead to to a political solution. This conflict has been going on 50 years, and there are people who are more than willing for it to go on for another 50 years. Not me, and certainly I don't think the President of the United States, but they're out there, and we're going to have to deal with it.
We just have about a minute. What's your long-term thought about Iraq, or do you have a long-term thought about Iraq?
Yeah, I was listening to the news this morning. There are two more bombings in Baghdad, and the spate of violence seems to ebb and flow, but it's still there. But I think long term, the Iraqis are interested in building stable political institutions, and they've become quite adept at negotiating or not negotiating or having talks or not having talks, and horse trading votes with each other, which is all a good sign. I think that slowly but surely democratic values are taking root inside of Iraq. It might take many years before we see real progress, but I don't think we're going to see a return to the bad old days in Iraq, and I think things are eventually going to get better, and we are going to withdraw all of our troops, and we'll have a democracy, albeit a democracy that is a fledgling democracy going through some growing pains in Iraq within the next 4 or 5 years. I'm very optimistic.
Hmm. And though, how long do you think the significant numbers of Americans are still going to have to be there?
I think that we'll probably have a thumbnail battalion of Americans inside of Baghdad or in one of the provincial capitals for maybe many years, 5 to 10 years. But it will be only a remnant, perhaps 1,000 or 2,000, several companies of Marines maybe. But a long-term military commitment is simply not in the cards. We're leaving. We want to leave, and we have to leave.
All right. Our guest, Mark Perry. If you'd like to read more of his thoughts, look for the book Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. It's published by Basic Books. He's a military intelligence, foreign affairs analyst and writer. He's author of 7 books and has contributed to The Nation, Washington Post, L.A. Times, among other papers. Mr. Perry, thank you very much.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713.
And we'll break as we usually do so we can bring you an update on the markets and news. We'll be back with more Focus, so please stay tuned.